I'm Brian Roth, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. There's a lot beer lovers may miss when they travel to the Pacific Northwest, a region overwhelmed not just with breweries, but really good ones. And while there are plenty of businesses that captivate beer geeks, one in particular has long caught my eye. Seattle's Rubens Brews is something of a rocket ship in an area pleasantly saturated with some of the best beer in the country. The name might not sound familiar to those outside Washington. Amongst the phenomenal growth of Rubens Brews, Adam and Grace have faced typical challenges not entirely unique to their company, ranging from the kinds of brands they make to how they're sold. However, Adam's methodical processes and logical focus continue to push together aspects of art and science that drives the brewery's core ethos. You'll find the way that he talks about making beer, and the level of detail he requires to do so, can be rather inspiring. Above all else, however, this is a family business. The beer is important, but not as much as the people that surround it. The namesake of the brewery, Adam and Grace's son, Reuben, is seen as a future. There's been plenty of success so far, but this is still the start of a much longer journey. This is Adam and Grace Robbins of Rubens Brews. Listen in.
So I think one of the things that that interested me about chatting with you guys, as I was telling others that I'm chatting with people from Rubens Brews, is Reuben one of the people you're talking to? No, it's Adam and Grace. And so I think maybe just to kind of set the context a little bit, tell me a little about Reuben. Why Rubens Brews?
Yeah. So, well, I'm Grace and this is Adam. And Reuben is our son. So he's kind of the reason why we got started in all of this. So soon after he was born, Reuben and I purchased Adam a home brewing kit for his birthday. So Reuben was probably 2 months old. And that's kind of what got Adam started in this. He'd been interested in beer for a long time and tasting beer and saying, I think it could be better if it were like made like this. So it was sort of one of those like, okay, if you think you can do better, why don't you try? So Reuben and I got him a home brewing kit. And, you know, it started out as a hobby, but then kind of quickly became obsession. And after a few months, we poured at a beer festival right here in the neighborhood, at the Finney Neighborhood Association. And as homebrewers there, we won the People's Choice Award. So we're like, this is so cool. We could do this, you know. Every 6 months, we could pour at this beer festival. But soon after that, they stopped allowing homebrewers. So we couldn't do that anymore. But why Rubens Brews? The night before that festival, they said, okay, we're printing the programs. You need to have a name for your beer. And we thought, oh.
We hadn't even thought of that, had we? Yeah. Kind of basic fundamentals.
But yeah. Yeah. But I mean, that's not where we were going with it. Right. So kind of on a whim, we just said, well, Reuben is the one who got us started on it. So Rubens Brews. But it is funny because when he goes to, you know, beer events, you know, people get on the mic, Reuben's in the house. But it's not Reuben, it's Reuben's dad.
So that thought process of going pro, or at least people telling you to go pro, I think is a conversation that often pops up for homebrewers. It's you have friends or family who really like something that you've made, and then all of a sudden it's, you could make this professionally, right? What was it, Adam, that you think made people react like that to what you were making? What is the process, or what is it that's so important to you that kind of started incubating that idea?
So I think the sort of the standard story is you start brewing your beer, you give it to your friends, they like it, they say you go pro, and you go pro, right? Well, the friends are inherently biased because they're your friends, and they're getting free beer. So they're going to say it's great, right? Because they'll, unless it's like, it's not going to kill them, but if it's getting towards that way, they won't want any more. But so what we did, or what, you know, I did from a brewing perspective was I focused on competitions as a home brewer. So trying to brew to a specific style, trying to recreate a style based off of words, right? This is the style guideline for whatever beer, say an American brown ale. Okay, let's think about what that recipe would need to create that flavor profile. And then let's brew it, and let's not trust what I think or our friends think. Let's go for anonymous people that they don't know us and get feedback from them, some validation or constructive criticism, and then carry on that feedback loop. So we got to a point where I was one of the top homebrewers in the state. From that beer festival that we poured at, we were getting emails from people bars asking us for our beer, right? And we just had a homebrew, 25-gallon system in the garage, which for a homebrew is pretty big, right? But that meant I could do four different batches at once to get, understanding more different styles. So for me, it was about not just that people like it, it was that we're getting validation from a peer group of independent validation.
That all seems very deliberate in the process, too, that you were thinking about it in terms of maybe not avoiding, but strongly considering the feedback from these other sources, whether it's a competition or people that you simply don't know. In that moment thinking, why was that so important to you? Was it?
Well, so I think you need to know the journey, really. So, I came to the U.S. in 2004, and I came with a presumption of coming to the land of macro light lager. Let's just say that. Don't want to name any brand names, right? But and couldn't have been further from the truth. Coming into Seattle in 2004, there was a vast amount of different styles. Different breweries that were doing really great stuff. And it sort of opened my mind to what beer could be. And that's where, when we met, I was in the journey of understanding that a lot better. Then understanding what different hops taste like, what different malts taste like, what a style should be versus what it could be versus what it is. And then taking it a little bit further on that sort of path, and when Ruben and Grace got me at the homebrew kit, I started brewing. And then it was less than a year after I actually started brewing intensely that we won the People's Choice at that festival. So I hadn't even been brewing for a year and people are asking, bars are asking us for our beer. So for me, we only just bloody started brewing, right? So how can we do this, right? Well, so then went to UC Davis, got some sort of proper training in inverted commas, and carried on learning. I had a lot to learn, and I think it was a good way of learning.
What was it, maybe, Adam, in terms of making the beer, Grace, perhaps you can talk about in terms of being part of the process or even just tasting it too, what was it about the actual thing that you're doing, the action of making those beers that you think made them so successful in the eyes of others? What was it you were paying so close attention to make them so good?
Well, from my take on it, is that he just has a ridiculous palate. I mean, so he tastes things that I can't taste. So I joke because he's British and grew up eating boiled vegetables. He has
They're lovely.
Whereas he says, I grew up, I'm half Korean, eating kimchi, I burnt off all my taste buds. So he tastes things that I can only taste after I have the suggestion of it. So I think you were just going for something very particular. And you talk about the feedback, and it's not really about the validation. I feel like, we've done a lot and accomplished a lot as a brewery, but we still are constantly seeking feedback on what we're doing, because otherwise I think you just get stale. But I'll let you.
Yeah, I'm very curious how that continues to play out even today, because, when you're starting and you're, even if it's not even thinking about having a professional side to it, it's still a case where that kind of feedback and that thought process just helps you make something that's better that you can enjoy more, right?
Yeah.
But even now that you have, you know, a very successful brewery, you've got four facilities here in Seattle, Washington, there's still certainly some aspect of that's a mindset, right, that you just can't get rid of, that you want to keep on getting better and thinking more intimately about what you do. Are there specific aspects of that process or what you did or how you did things as a home brewer that still kind of impact the way that you're thinking about the beers that are made and sold today?
Yeah, I think everything we do is not static. It's all part of a journey, and we're never there. You know, we never arrived, right? So whether it's any of our like main beers or a new beer, I'm always thinking about how we can improve the recipe. Not that's it, it's done, right? And I'm talking about really small margins of difference, you know, that most people won't know or taste or think about. But
what's an example of that?
An example of that is, I've got a couple of examples. So when one of our hazy IPA series, When hazy IPAs are a little young, they're a little green, right? So I've been thinking, because you're dry hopping so intensely, it normally takes a little while to sort of soften out. So what we've been doing is working on how long the beer sits in the tank after the dry hop to round out. So we're working on that process, and how many days is it before it's round and it's lost that sort of young green character. That's one idea. Another thing, and they tend to be process more than recipes now. Recipe changes. When in the whirlpool do we add hops to reduce isomerization of bitterness? Right. So we can extract a lot of IBUs out of a whirlpool addition. Well, let's look at when in the whirlpool do we add the hops? Do we drop the temperature of the whirlpool down? So a lot of process, a lot of opportunities for process, I won't say improvement, but more changing our process to try and get something that's incremental for the beer. If we maybe get a little fewer IBUs out of a whirlpool addition, but get a little better sort of aroma and flavor out of a whirlpool addition, individually people might not notice that. But when you combine that with maybe our changes to the dry hopping process and everything else incrementally adds up, is the opposite of what we don't want to do, which is you asked like how are our beers maybe slightly different to others. We don't want to think like a production brewery. So we don't have a house yeast strain that we have to use in every beer. We don't have a house base malt that we have to use in every beer. We don't only have like one type of roast barley or one a few types of different hops. Like if I want to design a recipe, I think about it unconstrained. Like I want this beer to taste like this, and to do that, it needs these things. I don't care what I've got in house to achieve that, which creates, you know, process inefficiencies and complexity. But if you start compromising on that path, that ends to this land of homogenization in my mind, right? Maybe you could take out this specific, like say Pilsner malt out of one of our IPAs and replace it with pale, right? Okay, maybe that doesn't hurt. But where do you go next after that? Do you then maybe take out this one hop because we don't contract it with too many other beers, so we can reduce that and cut that out totally, make our lives a lot easier? Well, if you start on that path, I don't like where that is going on the journey.
Is there a threshold then, or something that you're aware of in terms of that cutoff point between? Because I think what you're talking about is this cutoff point between craft as an art and craft as an industrial process, which making beer is,
yes.
Certainly. But it sounds like in the terms that you're trying to think about it, both as a science and in the actual physical function of making beer, that there is some point where you think you might be crossing over into losing that artistic side of it?
I think if you think of yourself constrained in any way, I think you've gone over the cliff.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm guarding against doing that at all, right? So we don't do any of those things that I was saying that you could do in theory, but we've never done anything like that, because I don't know where, that's not the journey, thinking about this thing as a journey, we don't, that's not the journey we want to be taking, right? That's not, everything we do should make the beer better. It shouldn't make our life, it shouldn't be done because it makes our lives easier. Yeah.
In both of the roles that you guys have within the brewery, or many roles, right? That's how it usually works.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you keep that perspective?
One of our brewers came to me with a recipe. So I have three, I was going to say spreadsheets, but this sounds really kind of sad. I have three spreadsheets people need to fill out if they want to do a beer, right? That's, you know, I was an accountant by my former trade, but that's not linked into this at all. But basically, I need to know the water analysis, the water profile analysis. I need to know the how they've run it through our brewing software. And then I want to see the recipe sheet. So sounds better than three spreadsheets, I guess. But so Leslie came to me with a recipe for a suggested beer. And I asked her about, like, why did you use this malt? And she told me that's because she knows we got it in-house. And I said, no, I'm not going to look at this anymore. I want you to go away and think, forget what we've got in-house. Just tell me what you want. And if the recipe is good, we'll do it. That's the most obvious answer. And to that, you know.
How about you, Grace, in the way that you kind of handle the things that you do with the brewery and the way you interact with staff or customers who come in too, is thinking about it in these terms of trying to maintain this perspective of what lack of boundaries, I guess, is a good way to put it.
Well, I think one thing that we did recently was the homebrew competition we hosted here. So it's called Hop Idol. And that was a fun one. We have the beer on tap right now. That's why I'm thinking of it. But so we selected a recipe and it used a hop that we had never used before. So it was, again, one of those things where we're going to be kind of pushing our boundaries and not just getting kind of used to or complacent in what we've always been doing, but deliberately trying to find new things to do. And the tap room, I mean, like I said, I think the continuous feedback and using that feedback loop, we interacting with people who come into the tap room who ask for specific styles of beer and or provide feedback on the beer that we do have, I think that just kind of, I think it's just always at the forefront of our mind. We're always trying to make each next glass of beer better than the one before it. So
in kind of the way that you guys are thinking about these things, there's this a bit of a dichotomy that's kind of appearing in my mind, where the processes and the thoughts that go into how you guys handle the business or make the beer are very very focused on that final product and how you guys can make it better, whether it's through efficiencies in the actual making of the beer or making, like you said, Adam, these small tweaks along the way that ultimately can add up to something else. The flip side of that is that customers either don't know this or wouldn't notice it, right? And you had mentioned that, you know, some of these things are simply things that you're aware of. Like you said, Gracie's got that excellent palate, right? Mm-hmm. So these are things you can pick up on. Why bother with these processes if in the grand scheme of things, and you guys have obviously seen good success, it's not something that's picked up by a drinker that comes in the tap room?
Two things. They're incremental, right? So individually, they won't be necessarily noticed, but when they're cumulatively put together, they will be noticed. So I would argue that they are noticed. And it's a long term, we're in this for the long term. So over a number of years, by doing this a number of different times, there'll be the cumulative effect of all of that will be very noticeable. I think you know, we're lucky to be in such a, an area that has such a great love and knowledge for craft beer. So I think the average, drinker in the Northwest is really knowledgeable, and they know that difference. You know, we enter competitions like I did as a home brewer to get that independent validation, because everybody's palate is different, right? You know, good beer is in the eye of the beholder. You know, it's And but competitions give us the validation, and we've won more medals for our beer than anybody else in the state since we opened. So I think that kind of shows that we're on the right track. And I think only thinking of it as unconstrained can keep us on that path. I think if you start having a tolerance for what I would call maybe shortcuts or, you know, making it easier, then I think you're on a slippery slope.
How does that impact your bottom line? Having this kind of, there is a very freewheeling and for obviously your benefit mindset where let's not box ourselves in. If we have this ingredient, no, think about this a different way because we should feel free to think about it differently. But there's also the very real consequence of running the business and how that impacts the real life day-to-day stuff, right? So how do you guys kind of balance that?
That's a good question.
If you want to break out another spreadsheet.
Yeah. was a good example. So our crush series. So there are ways that you can, manage some of this exposure in terms of, we have the tap room, right? So if a beer is incredibly expensive to make, it's taproom only release because we can't afford to do it another way. Because you also have to be reasonable about it. You can't go to the market and say, yeah, this sick barrel is going to cost you $200 and it's just an IPA or something, you know. You have to be within the market constraints, and you can be maybe on the higher end if you can justify it. But we try and be reasonable about our pricing. We realize that there's a customer at the end of the day, and we want them to like our beer and drink it and enjoy it, but we're not in this to get a big bottom line. You know, we're in this to do it right. And if it means that we're maybe putting 3 pounds of hops per barrel in a batch, whereas you could reduce it to 2 and make an extra $10 a barrel off of that beer, that's not what we're in this for. That's not what got us where we are. Anything? It's hard. It's hard. Sure. You certainly don't come into this industry to make any money. That's what it seems
right.
like.
You know? And part of that too, I'm curious because, you know, Seattle is a very both progressive and mature market in terms of, so not even thinking about it in terms of pricing, you know, what that cost might be per bomber or per can that people see with Rubens Brews slapped on it. But even the kinds of beers that you're making. So my exposure to you guys has been limited and very ad hoc, having family in Seattle. I first learned about you guys because my brother told me that there was this porter that I had to have, which kind of knocked my socks off.
Cool.
And I visit the tap room, and you've got a New England IPA. And granted, you know, I'm out of the area. I don't see you guys. I'm not exposed to you guys. But in my limited memory, I'm thinking, man, there's this really great traditional style that they just nailed. And I come in and, oh, there's something that's very, very modern and in trend with what people are interested in today, right? So in regard to kind of the philosophy that you have and the way that you're thinking about your process and what you're making and how you're making it, how has that impacted kind of your growth in terms of the variety or discussions? When someone comes with these three spreadsheets, obviously the world is your oyster and what that ends up as. But in terms of kind of, again, that journey that you're mentioning, Adam, and exploring what you can create and what represents Rubens Brews, how has that kind of evolved over the years?
So we opened up on our very first day in August 5th, 2012, with a Roggen beer on tap, a dry stout, an American brown, an American rye, I think a porter.
Porter.
We obviously didn't think about the marketing of these things, right? It's a really hot, sunny day, and we had one light beer. Everybody goes, wow, they don't make IPAs. Well, we had two IPAs, but they weren't ready yet, so they weren't coming out, right? So it's kind of interesting, because when we first started, we were known for rye beers. People would say, oh, yeah, they make great rye beers. And then the conversation moved to us making really good stouts and porters, like our porter and our bourbon barrel imperial stout and other dark beers. So then that's became the conversation, what we're known for. And then the last time I've heard us ever been put in a genre or a category was when newspaper called us a hop powerhouse, right? So now we're known for hoppy beers. But it's very hard to convey and hard for people to understand that we like brewing all different things. Like we don't want to just be known for hops and sours, or we want to be known for every single style, right? So because that's where, you know, in the diversity of everything on the board, I think that's where our strength is, our ultimate strength. It's kind of interesting because we were at capacity in the small brewery, our original place, within 6 months. It was April 2013, and we had put in a new tank, and that was it, and that was all we could fit. And I quit my day job to find another space, basically. And it wasn't until when we were sitting down one night, like the light bulb went off, right? We were thinking, well, we don't want to get a bigger brewery because that would mean we'll just make fewer beers, but more of fewer beers. And it wasn't until we realized, well, we have to keep the original brewery because then we can have a lot more flexibility. Mm-hmm. And that was what is fun for us, different styles. So that's why the tap room has 25 beers on tap now. And we have 2-3 in line waiting for other ones to blow so we can put them on. Because we have a 5-barrel brewery and a 15-barrel brewery. And what we've never really sat down and thought about what do we want people, or how do we want people to think about us? We've just kept our heads down and, you know, brewed what we wanted to brew and worked as hard as we could. And that's been, then people have picked up on our beers as they are right then, not as what we're really trying to do, if you like. So we want to brew multiple different styles and continually like evolve and push things forward. And
it might be bad news for our bottom line right now. Like, as you pointed out, the lack of efficiencies in the production, it probably would be a lot easier and simpler on all of us if we just made a ton of, you know, 3 different styles of beer. But I think for the longevity of, you know, we're in this for the long haul. And yeah. I think doing all these different things allows us to be nimble, you know. Yeah. I think the market was super into rye beers a few years ago, and then pumpkin a few years ago as well. And trends change, things change. What people want to drink changes. And I get that because what I want to drink changes too. So I think being nimble and like dabbling in all these different things allows you to be able to pull off lots of different things.
So just to be clear, because you said that you haven't had the opportunity to explain how you want people to think about you, is that nimbleness, that flexibility, the way that you try to define who you are?
I wish we had time to think about how to define
Give me your mission statement on the spot.
Well, not only did we, like I said, like opening day, we didn't exactly think about the opening day beer.
Why not?
I was actually thinking about yeast propagation, and if I brew this beer, then I can brew this beer after and this beer after, like with like our Irish strain that we bring in.
Was there something about that, you know, you're opening a business, so there's lots of things to think about, right? But not thinking about the lineup perhaps in the hindsight 2020 that you can now is a great thing to do, but was there something there kind of blocking you? Was it blinders on that you had these beers that you felt very confident about, that you had good feedback about, and that was it? Or was there something else just in terms of kind of starting that business that you didn't quite know about yet?
I think of it partly as this might sound a bit weird, but we want to be different, right? We want to not come out with like 5 IPAs on the first day. The first beer we ever brewed as a commercial brewery was a Roggen beer, which is kind of unusual, but it was one of my favorite beers as a home brewer to brew, right? And it was fun. And so that opening lineup was more, I guess, what almost interested me. You know, interested me. You were taking Reuben out of town for a bit, hadn't you? So when when Mike, my brother-in-law, and I were brewing, I honestly didn't consciously think of what I wanted people to think when they first came through the door. And that showed through in a few things. So like hindsight is a wonderful thing, but like our original tap room, you were literally just sitting in the middle of the brewery, and we put benches up in front of the fermenters at the weekend when people would come in and brew. People would come in and drink in the tap room, and then at the weekend and in the week, we'll move them out of the way and then brew in that same space. So that you had the space, you're literally in the middle of the brewery. And it was within walking distance of the house, which is an important thing for us, you know. It was also, we had Ruben's, what would that be, second birthday party?
Mm-hmm.
It was his second birthday party in the space before we started building it. And he was like, got his first little bike, and he's like riding round and round and round. And we thought, well, you know, if this all goes horribly wrong, because I kept my other job for the first year and a half, right? If it goes horribly wrong, he can just carry on riding his bike around here and we don't lose the house, right? So my analogy is you're dipping your toe in the water to see if it's cold or not in the pool, but you're actually falling in. Right? And if we had have realized at the time we're falling in, maybe we would have done something different, but I don't think we would have, because...
And who knows how it would have turned out had we done something different.
Probably wouldn't have turned out as well.
Right? I think there are definitely times. I mean, considering we, you know, reached capacity in our initial space a few months or weeks maybe after we opened, it's sort of like, oops, like we should have maybe thought about this a little differently. But then again, who knows how it would have turned out? I mean,
what are the, looking at it from that perspective too, the growth rate at which you guys have seen, so halfway through 2017, you were the fastest growing brewery in the state of Washington. And this is harkening back to that 6 month time point 5 years ago when you were figuring out what the heck are we going to do next. What are the challenges that people don't know about when you guys are faced with something like that? So now you've got some space, you've got experience, but along those 5 years, it seems like a rocket pace. What are the things that you've experienced that you've had to think about that just aren't out there for people to see?
Scalability of your brewery is one thing that you need. You know, hindsight would be great to have known. Within in the first 2 years, we're constrained in our original space. So every year we've produced at capacity. So when you're looking at those growth rates, it's just because our capacity has gone up. When we moved from the small brewery to the larger brewery, within 5 weeks, we're at our 5 year volume run rate goal. Right? So
how does that feel?
Yes. I had more hair. I had a lot more hair. That's why I'm growing a beard now. So, you know, hindsight is wonderful. We wanted to be in the city. And that meant there were trade-offs to that. So it meant that you couldn't get a big warehouse and then expand necessarily. I think when we first started, I didn't even think about having accounts, having customers, on-premise customers. It was just Mike, our brother-in-law, myself, and Grace, right,
mm-hmm.
at the start. And within those first few months, we ended up having 50 on-premise customers, you know. So that was from buyers coming in and asking us for our beer. Well, it was me, Mike, Grace. Well, we had to then deliver all of these, and I didn't have any cake. So we've come at this from a very unscripted perspective. It sounds even worse when you say it out loud. especially as my prior job was about long-term planning and forecasting for a pretty big company. So we had, neither of us are entrepreneurs. We never had done anything like this. And so I came from more of a risk mitigation perspective. Like, how do we make sure we don't lose the house? How do we make sure we don't go bust and lose everything? And let's just concentrate on what we want to be doing.
GBH is made possible by the financial contributions of our underwriters. Guinness, our first major underwriter, is helping us bring you a completely new series of stories called Coming to America, featuring upstart and iconic breweries from around the world who are trying to make their way in the U.S. in the age of local. As part of the Guinness Coming to America section, we'll be featuring new wave breweries as well as long-standing imports like our latest focus on Triple Carmelite, as it celebrates its 20th anniversary of being imported to the United States. We're thrilled to be digging into these stories, and like this podcast and many of our other projects, Coming to America wouldn't be possible without our underwriting support from companies like Guinness. Watch for more underwriters and new themes like Coming to America in the coming months. We're also supported by the Fervent Few, a growing community of GBH fans, including some professional supporters like Cloudwater Brew Co. in Manchester, UK, Four Pure Brewing Company in London, The Mitten Bar in Ludington, Michigan, Sound Growler Brewing from Tinley Park, Illinois, Magic Rock Brewing from Huddersfield, England, Honest Brew, Siren Craft Brew, Two Tribes Brewing, and Beer Hawk, all from the UK, Boundary Brewing in Belfast, and Ireland Craft Beers, an exporter, as well as 1911 Established Cider and Spirits from New York, and Signal Hill Products from Cape Town, South Africa. They all support us through their monthly Pro Tier subscriptions. You can join the Fervent Few by visiting patreon.com, that's patreon.com/goodbeerhunting. So like you were talking about in terms of the evolution of the variety of beers that you guys made, that certainly changes. Like you were saying, people recognized you for rye beers and then stouts and porter, and now you're a hop powerhouse, right? And being in this area, Pacific Northwest especially, this is not a place where you can skimp. People, like you were mentioning, people know what, or at least people have an idea of what they like and what is or is not quote unquote good beer, right? So that's all subjective, but they have a good idea because they're exposed to it so much. But the way that you guys have grown, which you say fast, certainly indicates that there's success in a very competitive market. So in the way that, you know, whether it's these new brewers or the new styles that you're talking about, or the way that you think and talk about your beer and your brands to people, how has that led to success in this market? Certainly there's challenges that occur being here in Seattle, here in the state of Washington as well.
You know, there's art and science in beer, you know, it's a cliche. The science is, I think, relatively easy. The art is the harder part. And by that, I mean, the only thing I have is, I think, I call it a feedback loop. So I can come up with a recipe and then, or I can actually think about what I want something to taste like, come up with a recipe, brew it, compare it to what I had in my head that I was trying to get, and then iterate the recipe back. And that's really the only thing I've got, and I think it probably was because I grew up on bland food. Sorry, Mum, but that's what I think is maybe our only, you know, at the core, a very key part of all of this. On top of that, you know, Mike has been amazing from the start. So Mike, our brother-in-law, he had a framing business in Illinois, and 1 year, it was Halloween, and I brought out my pumpkin beer for that year. And he was was it Bud Light? He thinks there's a Bud Light and Coors Light difference. I can't remember which one it was, but I don't get the difference. But he was one of those two, and vehemently one of those two. I think it was Bud Light.
Okay.
And that was his gateway beer, my pumpkin beer, because he like was hoarding it. Remember, I never forget. He was like hiding it, like so nobody else would have any more of it, so he could have it all to himself. And he said, probably in a pumpkin beer drawn stupor, that if we ever open a brewery, he'll come and help us. So once we have we signed the lease to that place, the original space. The next thing we did was call him up and say, right, you're coming. And it was like, oh. And now Liz, his wife, works, and Grace's sister works for us as well. I think he was a big part of what got us to where we are. Because those first 50 batches we brewed at weekends or on my vacation days, and I brewed with him every batch, and I started off leading them, and by the end I was just watching him, right? So he was, I sort of trained him on those 50 batches, and that consistency really helped. We, despite being small, we deliberately set up to multi-batch, so two batches into one fermenter every time. So we were set up every beer to basically blend to be consistent, which I think made us a big, helped us out a lot at the start. And we've carried on that philosophy to now, and I wouldn't change that. Because, you know, individual batches can have a different, decent variability, but if you're having two goes into one, you can adjust the second, right? And he, you know, without him, I don't know what it would have been like at the start. It would have been, I don't know.
Looking back at those early days I still had my day job as well. It was these two guys brewing everything, Mike moving all the furniture, serving in the tap room on the weekends. I mean, it's crazy. I don't know how we survived, honestly. Like, it was crazy.
And Mike literally built the brewery. So he made the cold room. He like built the walls, insulated them according to code, ran through the inspections. Built these the benches. Now this was an issue because he built the benches as if he was building a house, so they'd have withstanded like a nuclear attack. But they were impossible to move. They were so heavy. They were like rocks, but they're really solid. But no, he literally came in March, I think, and we opened in August. So he came over, and his wife and daughter were still in Illinois, and then they came.
November,
in that first year.
Tell me more about the familial ties around all of this, because it obviously goes beyond the name of the brewery, right? Both between you guys and then bringing in family members too. How has that helped to support, but also maybe even change the way that you approach the business?
Well, I think going back to your earlier question too, I think that's been a huge part of our success. I mean, we have people who are 1,000% committed to seeing this thing go well. And I think in some ways being a family outfit helps us be accessible maybe to people in Seattle. You know, more approachable. Like we are a family owned business, and like, you can walk in and see me or my sister working behind the bar, or Mike working behind the bar. And, you know, and I think we're pretty active in our community too. So supporting some of the work that's being done by local nonprofits and things like that. So I think the connections are strength for us. So family connection within our team, but then also connections we have to the community. Yeah.
How do you guys, so you two, I guess specifically, how do you guys take a break from it?
What's that?
That's a great question.
So I had the chance to talk with the Trogues brothers, Chris and John Trogner, in Pennsylvania this summer. And they told me about how they expected, since they were 6 years old, that they were going to have a business together, which kind of floored me. One, that, you know, they have this close enough bond to do that, but also the perspective to think that this is just the way it was going to be, right? And there is very much, I mean, having partners in life be a part of a business is certainly nothing new. This is a big part of entrepreneurship. But there are still aspects that I think are kind of navigated or negotiated through the process. And so I'm curious for the way that you guys have approached it, especially Grace, because you've been involved since the beginning, but it was just somewhat recently that you officially came on, right? How it's kind of impacted the way that you guys think about business, and also where you kind of draw that line between, okay, so this is going to be family time now that we get to spend with Reuben.
Yeah, unfortunately, the line is not that clear there. We end up talking about all things brewery related at all hours all the time.
It's definitely something we need to get better at doing. It's actually been harder with you coming on board full time to have that separation, because we can't talk about your work that's not the brewery, right? You know, it's kind of all encompassing. It's like in the UK there aren't, I don't think there are too many entrepreneurs, right? Obviously there are, but I was brought up to, should I get into this?
Yeah.
Not look down on entrepreneurs, but like you aspire to be a profession, right? So you don't aspire to be an entrepreneur. And me and my friends, like when we were in middle school, we started a school magazine and had tuck shops. But I don't know, I guess they're not called that here.
What is that?
Like a tuck shop. It's like
candy
a
store?
Snack.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so like a tuck shop would be a small like store at school where people would get like candy and stuff. Stuff to rot your teeth from. And so we did that, and that was a lot of fun. And I'll never forget my middle school teacher, Mr. Hopkins, writing in my card when we left, you know, let me know when you open your business and all this sort of stuff. But then you get ingrained in you that you shouldn't do that. You should join a profession. So that's kind of what I did, a bean counting one. And then that was all good. But like entrepreneurship is something I never thought about doing. And when you realize it, you're doing every job until you hire somebody to do that job. That's the sort of mantra that we think that sort of makes sense, right? If nobody else is there to do it, it has to be done. Well, we have to do it, right? Yeah. So, whether it's...
I know people ask me what I do, and I say I buy the pretzels for the tap room.
Or like, you know, unblock the toilets. Yeah. Or
to be fair, these are very important jobs.
Yes, indeed.
Like the oil, isn't it? And it keeps the whole thing moving.
But, it's all about the customer experience.
Yeah. But over time, I guess where I'm going with this is, over time you hire people to do those jobs. And as you get bigger, you can afford, hopefully, to hire people to buy the pretzels, to unblock the toilets when they block, or whatever it may be. And if we get to that point, that's when we can
take a break.
Like if we go to the UK to see my family, I'm the only one here. Every morning I'm normally working for 3 hours. And that's when I'm away, right? At least 3 hours, because it's normally that many emails and that many questions. But that's my thought, is eventually when we can hire for all these roles, then we should get to the point where we do ourselves out of a job. That's what I've said with every job I've ever done. My team should be able to, I should coach my team to build up to basically do me out of a job, and then I can then do the next one, whether it's in a big company moving to another team, or here it would be then looking at other things, right? So like my primary job is to look at where we want to be tomorrow, and everybody else in the team, I think their job is to work on where we are today. That's what I generally sort of say. But I end up spending more than half the day looking at where we are today and trying to figure that stuff out. Eventually I'd like to be focused totally on tomorrow.
And we need to have space to think of this, because Ruben is not an only child now.
So,
little brother Warren is in a few years going to realize that his brother has a brewery named after him and he's got nothing.
Yeah, so we need to figure that one out.
Let me extrapolate a different kind of challenge than that one. In terms of the way that things have kind of grown and changed for you guys, what are the challenges that you look at? So like Adam, you're talking about in terms of responsibilities and roles and how you think about that in terms of how you can delegate it and what that could and should be, right? What are the challenges just in terms of looking at kind of the market and how you guys are growing and changing, whether it's selling beer in Washington or elsewhere or at the tap room? What are things that are front of mind for you?
Well, I think considering that, you know, we have been at capacity basically every year since we've opened and been able to grow. In the meanwhile, we need to think about how we can grow smartly. Is that even a word?
So if you guys are the fastest growing brewery in Washington State, what hasn't been smart about what you've done to get to this point?
I mean, I think we have been smart, probably maybe too deliberate and cautious, which I think has been good. But as we continue to grow, I mean, there's a bit of a, you know, people like finding the hole in the wall place and walking in and saying like, hey, this beer is actually pretty good. I think it's harder sometimes for people to get behind the big dog already, you know? So I think we have been deliberate in thinking about how we grow so that we don't lose our authenticity and our connection with people. I mean, because we've been at capacity, we're like, I mean, should we consider contract brewing? And we've thought like that just kind of gets away from what we were trying to do. Like, we're trying to do this in a way that's true to us and to make the beer as well as we can make it. So help me out of this.
The only plan we had when we first opened was, how do we get open without losing all our money? That was the only plan we had. Didn't have any plan of what we're going to do this year, next year, the year after. I think what we're at a point now is, okay, so what do we want to be, right? We know what we are, we know how we do it, but where does that take us? And just recording this, right, we're sitting in the sour warehouse in the corner, resting on the box of a glycol system, right? It'd be nice to have an office, you know. Like crazy thoughts. But it would be nice to think about the longevity, right? And what do we want that to be? And I think the issue we have is, if you and Grace touched on this, if you get too big, you get away from what we want to be and what's our differentiator. So our differentiator is that we go from the glass backwards on every beer. We don't have a silo. Not that a silo is bad, but like that then gives us a forced perspective on not having to have one base grain in every beer, right? But what do we want? You know, what do we want from the longer term? How big should that be? And let's set those limits, right? You see the industry moving away from bigger regionals, right? Well, even nationals, you know, it's more local. Well, how do we come with what we are to that sort of, environment in a way that makes sense, not just today, but when Ruben is working, you know, he even though he says he doesn't want to work for us, he wants to be a baseball player, you know.
Been there.
when he's...
Has said, though, that when he's 20, he's going to work with his cousin Isla. That's Liz and Mike's daughter. So
there's hope.
Yeah, who knows what the future holds.
We want to create something that is long-lasting and is around for a long time. So what is that? And how do we define that? And how do we make that happen? And we've got away from that dipping our toe in the water. We've got away from, let's get a little bit more production. It's now what size makes sense with the constraints that we're putting on ourselves based on our beliefs, you know, what our core beliefs are. And I think we're getting there in our heads what that is. You know, it's a set amount of barrelage. You know, we're going to be never that big, but what size would that be? What size brew house would that be? What sort of beer list do we want? Do we want to move further into sour beers? Yes, we do. As you will be starting slowly, but we'll be getting there. I think we're thinking of that whole bigger picture now that we weren't even conscious of 5 years ago.
What is the back and forth that you consider And when you talk about growth, it sounds like you said that there's a barrelage that you have in mind. And Grace, you were talking about in terms of the aspect of local and you guys thinking about in terms of what that means versus something much larger. So there are two kinds of growth that you're talking about, both in terms of the practical, actual numerical value of crossing the 10,000 barrel threshold and on up, but also in space of craft, where it's maybe something new that you're making in the tap room or sour. What is the balance that you look at when thinking about that kind of stuff?
Can I just
go nuts?
Does anybody else want one? Do you want another one?
I'm good, yeah.
You're good.
But we'll get that extra little sound effect in, by all means. No, yeah. Embrace it.
Yeah, reverb helps, right?
Yeah, that was amazing. So balancing the kind of production
there's
volume
a lot
growth
of, so
versus...
I think what is unique about what is going on with Reuben's Brews, and not unique in the way that it's only happening to you, but unique in the way that perhaps is new to the industry, is that thinking about growth can be mutually exclusive, right? Both in terms of, okay, we want to make this much beer, or we want to grow in ways that we're diversifying our portfolio or find new ways to approach customers, things like that. And it sounds like there is a divergent point for you guys at somewhere in the future. And you're thinking about it. Why is that important?
I think it's important because of longevity initially, right? So you don't want to chase, you don't want to chase barrelage in an industry which is...
Plateauing,
maybe, or maybe moving towards more local, because... We're in the Northwest, so we're in Oregon, Idaho, Washington. That's our distribution footprint, and the UK as well, just for biased reasons, right? But that's it. We're not planning to do anything more than that. We want to make enough beer for our market, and then. We need to decide what that barrelage is, because if we're going to build something, we have to build it to that. And that's not going to be that big. I mean, that's going to be 20,000 barrels, something like that. But then sort of key to me, a lot of this is about challenge, right? So I like brewing new beer styles for the challenge of it and trying to come up with an idea and then implement it. And then carry on that feedback loop, then see how we want to do that. And so as we expand our sour program, that is a big challenge there. I think brewing a number of different styles will be a nice, even more styles will be a more of a challenge to us. I think I for one, get bored if we're just doing the same thing all the time. So I think to be relevant, you have to be embracing change. And that's only going to get a faster rate of change in the future. And create an organization that is self-sustaining in that context is I think what will keep us around in the future.
Change has gone from some traditional styles to hoppy stuff to sour in the near future. What is change in the future, even a little bit beyond that, in terms of the way that you think you have to stay relevant? Because it sounds like you're very aware of kind of the market pressures and what goes on in the industry and how you need to think about Reuben's Brews going forward. But there's also probably some specific things that in lieu of that you're thinking about, okay, so maybe we need to think about X, Y, and Z.
We've done all of those different beer styles all the time. So that's the first thing. So like when we opened, despite not having it right on day one, we always try to have something hoppy, something light, something dark, and something malty. So when somebody comes into the tap room, we have an option for anyone. And we also have options for people who say that they don't like beer without Gose or Berliner, or maybe, you know, like Grace said, we have to figure out something for Warren at some point. You know, maybe that's, you know, we branch out into, I don't know, cider or more into different elements. I don't know, can you think of it?
Well, it's a unique challenge, right? And I think that this is something that a lot of breweries have to think about right now, especially breweries your size who are having these same kind of conversations where it's, so we're making so much beer, we've had success locally. That's probably the smart place to stay the way that the industry is shaping right now. And so to think about those things, are conversations and thoughts that you have to have at this point, right? And that these are things that are just feel natural, and it's just kind of the flow of how you have to think about your business now.
I don't think so. We have so much shit to get done. I don't think we're in a point where, okay, so what? Let's think about what we need to do that we're not thinking about, right? I think we've normally got about 50 different styles of beer that are on the to-do list that we haven't gotten to. We've got a number of process and recipe improvements of existing beers that we want to get to. There's a load of hops that we want to play with that we haven't started playing with yet. Even just this year, we started finding some new hops and we're going to bring one of those into our spring seasonal next year. So I think almost every day new things come up. I think there's the to-do list doesn't get any shorter. It just gets constantly longer.
One of the things that you said when you first came to the States, it's 2004.
Yeah.
You were coming to the land of bland light lager.
Yeah.
It's been a big full circle for you, right? What's the most important thing that you've learned?
Stereotypes, actually. So the stereotype of the US from the UK is everything's that bland light lager and McDonald's, right? And then the stereotype when you're here, looking back at the UK, that all the food is really bland and everybody has bad teeth. Neither of which I was aware of existed as a stereotype outside of home, right?
He never understood that in Austin Powers.
I never understood the Austin Powers bad teeth thing. I just thought, well, that's just really weird. So, you know, that from all of this is the irony of it kind of is coming over here, the UK was dominated by bland macro lager and macro bitter. But we were trained there to think that that was good, you know? Coming over here, I realized what craft was, and I could then see what I had left behind and the sort of lackings of that. Coming over here, I could see how good the food could be, and Seattle has got a great food here. But still going home, I was only focusing on the things that I knew, right, that was good. We don't just boil our vegetables every day, but, you know, and the teeth thing, that was a different, I didn't get that at all. I guess I got lucky. Yeah, so.
And things are changing now, yeah, in the UK as well. One thing I noticed when we went back is that it's almost too bad that the craft movement and the real ale movement aren't like joined up better. They're sort of at odds with each other. And it's like, no, join forces and go against the evil empire. Mm-hmm. But I think things are changing in the UK too.
And their craft, the craft scene there is exponentially improving, and getting really, really a lot better. Yeah, it's nice to go back and see how it changes, like, so quickly. I think they've learned a lot from what the US does, and you know, they're on a very fast growth curve in every way, like, just not just barrelage, but in terms of just learning.
Mm-hmm. Well, cheers to life lessons, then. It's worked out for you well so far. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, folks. As things slow down around the holidays, spend some time over at the Good Beer Hunting website, where we've got plenty of news and insight to keep you busy. In our latest collection of sightlines, Dave Eisenberg digs into how the real estate empire of a former Golden Road co-founder is reshaping Los Angeles's beer scene. And also, Dave shows how a new law could change alcohol consumption in Finland. We've got a first contribution from David Ferris, an associate professor of political science at Roosevelt University, who gives us lots of historical and cultural context to this week's tax reform legislation for breweries. After a long sabbatical, Mike Sardinia is back, sitting down for a critical drinking session with Dan Kleben of Maine Beer Company. Click over to read Dan's take on the importance of independence, sustainability, and what it's like for a business preparing for a major expansion. We also heard from our Fervent Few community, which shared their picks for beers from 2017 that forced them to rethink beer styles altogether. Thanks to Tyler Bello, Shannon Vinson, Manny Gumina, and more for their insight. If you want to join the fun and become part of the Fervent Few, check out patreon.com, that's patreon.com/goodbeerhunting. As part of the community, you get access to a host of perks, in addition to sharing your voice with those of us on the GBH editorial team. We're so thankful for the support, encouragement, and inspiration of the Fervent Few, and what they offer beer lovers too. Thanks to all our readers and listeners who make Good Beer Hunting a part of their routine. We've got a couple of events coming up, including the Uppers and Downers Festival February 24th in Chicago. Tickets are on sale now for two sessions, where visitors can enjoy a variety of coffee and beer, and tickets to this event might just make for a good holiday gift. You can find more info at goodbeerhunting.com/events. That's going to be it for this week. Our music is produced by Andrew Thibodeau, and our sound engineer is Jordan Stalling of Particle Audio. Aim true, pour liberal, folks. Happy holidays. Have a great week.